On today's episode of The Good Word, Jake Fisher joins me to talk about Team USA men's basketball, including Jaylen Brown playing games in the media, Joel Embiid being treated like a traitor by the French, and Kevin Durant showing us why he might be the best international basketball player we've ever seen. All that and more coming up right now.
Good Word with Goodwill on Yahoo Sports. Ball don't lie. And here is Vince Goodwill.
Welcome to The Good Word. My name is Vincent Goodwill, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. We're part of the Ball Don't Lie podcast. Get us wherever you get your podcast. I am joined today by the other senior reporter for Yahoo Sports, the one and only Jake Fisher. Jake, how you doing, man?
I'm good, man. I'm fresh off a Two Americas experience last night.
What was the Two Americas experience last night? I'm almost afraid to ask.
I went to see one of my favorites, Sir, at the newly refurbished Brooklyn Paramount Theater in downtown Brooklyn. I was one of the only guys that looked like me there. It's a good time.
did anybody look at you and ask you, why are you here?
No, I flowed with it. We yelled the lyrics we knew, and that was it. It was a good time. Hey, hadn't seen him before. He was great. Took a shirt off. The girls went nuts. That's what you went for.
I mean, that ain't why I would go. You know what I mean? Like, you know, taking your shirt off, I'm more the person to tell somebody, put your shirt back on at a concert more than take it off.
Well, I didn't take it off. Sir, who is absolutely chiseled after apparently ballooning to like 250, played some Sway in the morning interview where he was talking about how he put on weight while he was in rehab and stuff and came back. Shout out Sir, man. He's so good. Chasing Summer, one of my favorite albums.
Hey.
Yeah.
We get a little bit of everything here, man. Look, it's the off season. You might hear a little bit of everything. You might even hear about a convention that's happening this week in Chicago and somebody being invited who might bring raisins and a potato salad. I'll let y'all figure out who that is. Jake, let's just assume we are in France right now for the Olympic Games. Neither one of us are there. We have an army of Yahoo writers and experts. I'm sure you guys see it on your website and on the app and everywhere else. But if you were there covering USA basketball, just covering the basketball, what would be the story that you'd be chasing?
Man, there's one story to me that takes the cake of all the Paris storylines. And it's not just the fact that he's the starting center for Team USA in a way that has brought, let's say, some discussion, some discourse about who should be starting. It's not just the fact that there could be a continued foul trouble issue with him in, you know, a game that only has five personal fouls instead of six. It's the fact that Boris Diaw and everyone from President Emmanuel Macron to whoever, they were putting on like a years-long effort to get Joel Embiid to play and join this iteration of Team France. And they were taking him to private dinners and wining and dining him. And you know, he's got this French passport. And of course, he defects and he chooses Team USA. And now he's getting booed left and right, and he's got hecklers telling him to give back his passport. That whole 360-degree situation to me, like I got Boris's number from someone this week because I was like, I'm going to call this guy, and I just like haven't had the chops to do it yet, just because I don't know, it might be sour grapes, who's to say? But that to me is definitely like the story of the basketball segment of this tournament, being that he's the starting center of the favorites who denied the home country that probably has a good chance of competing. I don't know. What about you?
It's something like that. I'll just say this. It's something like that because we're going to get to Joel Embiid. We're going to get to this AAU-ization of USA basketball. I'm sure you guys can probably figure out exactly what I'm talking about. We're going to get to that on the other side of the outlet. We got to hit the outlet first. Let's get into it. We'll be connected on a head-to-head pass and get through several pieces of NBA news quickly. First off, Phoenix Suns signing Tyus Jones. He was the best free agent left out there. It's kind of one of those games of musical chairs where probably if he doesn't sign on the first day, he's probably going to be waiting for a minute. And he was waiting, and he wound up signing like basically veteran minimum sort of deal with the Suns. A, Jake, does this sort of give the Suns a better than expected offseason, considering you're getting a starting caliber point guard, assuming that he's a starter, which it looks like at least he said he's going to be a starter? And B, how do we view the Suns offseason as a whole with the limited resources that they've had?
Yeah, I don't think he goes to Phoenix without some Joel Embiid, the Team USA type assurances he's going to be starting. Because, yeah, the word has been reported, I believe it to be true, that he had richer offers elsewhere. And I think ultimately his situation, we wrote about this at Yahoo, I forget exactly when, but in the immediate aftermath of the Denny Avdia trade to Portland that brought Malcolm Brogdon back, that really put Tyus Jones' future in Washington in question, where Tyus was one of, you know, 15 million has kind of been this like boogeyman number that's been out there for, that's the number of the extension that Gary Trent purportedly turned down in Toronto, and the AAV that Miami offered Caleb Martin before he turned them down. And the same thing with Tyus. I was told he had something in that $15 million ballpark, an extension available from Washington before the Denny Avdia deal. And he ends up on a minimum. Caleb Martin ends up on eight, Gary Trent a minimum. So I think from that perspective, it's just another interesting trend throughout the overall marketplace. To bring it back to Phoenix, yeah, it's a hell of an outcome for them, being that they got him on that 3.3 vet min that was, you know, a fifth of that salary. And
yeah,
even though Matt Ishbia and James Jones have come out publicly multiple times and said, like, we don't really need a point guard. You know, we get these three alphas and you want the ball in their hands all the time, so why take it out of their hands? Like, any coach you talk to values having someone who can just set the table and slow things down if you need to, or speed it up if you need to, and get your guys the ball in the right spots. And he can do that. I think the one question to me, you know, I was wondering, I think a lot of people around the league were wondering if this type of vet minimum guard was going to end up being Markelle Fultz, like a defensive-minded guy, which yeah, to me, that's the question now. To your question about the grade of this for Phoenix, like, now you put Tyus and Bradley Beal together in the same lineup with Devin Booker and Kevin Durant, there's not exactly like a wall of perimeter defenders out there when KD's getting older. Devin Booker is improving as a defender, but he is not, you know, the lockdown guy that I think most teams would want to have if you have a Bradley Beal, Tyus Jones backcourt.
Yeah, I think I look at the Suns. We're going to get to Kevin Durant on the other side when we look at the way that he's played in the first game, in his first game back from USA Basketball, and of course the existential question that revolves around Kevin Durant all the time. But just the team building element of this roster, it just looks uneven. And maybe signing Tyus Jones, an undersized point guard, but one who brings some order, can play with some pace, like you said, maybe that sort of shores up something, and the other issues aren't as exacerbated, you know what I mean, with this. But the issues are the issues. I don't think they're doing any real winning anytime soon because the West is too tough. Now, speaking of the Western Conference, Aaron Fentress, I believe, or the Oregonian, reported that, or he said on a radio interview, I believe, that the Blazers are shopping Jeremy Grant and Simon, that he expects one of them to not be there at the start of the season. Of course, there's a lot of smoke around Jeremy Grant and the Lakers, considering the Lakers have two first-round picks that they can offer, and assuming, you know, he would slide, be able to slide into that if the Lakers want to go into, you know, deeper tax territory and everything else with his sizable contract. But how do you see that, Jake?
Jeremy Grant, to my knowledge, dating back to the trade deadline, is someone who has communicated that he isn't necessarily invested long-term in a rebuilding situation like Portland. But I've been told from his representation, I've been told from the Trailblazers, that he's not asking out. He's not one of these guys who's, you know, giving a list of preferred destinations and saying, you know, only trade me to here. But I think just like with any big contract, the closer we get to that being an expiring deal, which yeah, I believe now he's in year two of this big deal after they gave him a huge 5-year, $160 million agreement. And then like 2 days later, Damian Lillard requests out. Now we're in year two of that. You know, I think execs start to think, oh, there's only three more years left after this. Like, people start to talk themselves into the contract if they like the player. And to your point, yes, the Lakers have, I think, limited options of players who are actually available, who are difference makers that they could foreseeably go and acquire. And to my knowledge, he is someone that's been on the radar. We've written that in the past. But I think in terms of like the immediacy to move one of these guys, I'm not necessarily so certain in that. Because to me, like, I checked in on Ant Simons' side of things back earlier in the offseason, and there was some temperature there of like, look, the Blazers have Shaedon Sharpe and Scoot Henderson, and they're just not exactly close to shaping into something. You know, look at, I think Orlando is kind of like the barometer now for all these rebuilds, right? Orlando, Houston, like a team that can kind of take a step forward.
Yeah.
And how do you do that if ostensibly a couple of your best players and your top development guys all play the same exact role? So I think come the trade deadline, yes, I think there is potentially a logjam to be remedied there. And Ant Simons is going to be super attractive on the trade market, being just 24 years old, if I recall correctly. And he's just at a $20 million AAV. Like, that's a very, very tradable salary in this landscape. I would expect there'll be plenty of teams calling on him. But to say there's like some deadline to move these guys before training camp, I haven't heard that. But anything, you know, a lot of teams have to reach 90%. I mean, every team has to reach 90% of the salary floor now before training camp happens. So that's effectively a new quote unquote deadline, just like December 15th, just like the actual trade deadline, just like how this August 6th, extension date for Larry Markkanen is a quote unquote deadline. And around the NBA, deadlines cause action. So could the training camp, you know, 90% salary floor thing instigate some type of deal work around the league? It's possible, but it's not something I'm like looking for to happen in Portland right now.
Yeah, it's Portland's in a weird spot because you got to give Scoot Henderson some runway to improve in year two. Like, you didn't necessarily see the sort of blinding speed, like the things that you thought you were going to see after his one season at G League Ignite, you did not see early. He struggled with the shooting. He struggled in getting to the lane. Like, the body and everything is still there. But you wonder with him and Shaedon Sharpe and Ant Simons, like, clearly the bulk of the minutes is going to have to go somewhere. And clearly you have invested so much in this guy, you're going to have to start giving him some room. Who knows what that means as far as training camp and deadlines and everything else. Now, the final piece, which is, I find, thoroughly entertaining and insane. Jaylen Brown versus Grant Hill. The celebrity sort of, remember the celebrity grudge match that they used to have back in the day? Maybe I'm dating myself with that.
We gotta get these guys on Jerry.
Oh my God, it's just ridiculous. Like, Grant Hill went on, I think he went on with Dan Patrick a few days ago, and Dan Patrick had asked him about Jaylen Brown not being on the Olympic team. And Grant was just joking and saying, oh, you know, I love a good conspiracy theory. And basically just goes and talks about all the basketball reasons why Derek White was selected. And he was very complimentary of Jaylen Brown throughout the whole process. Jaylen Brown takes it, listens to maybe a snippet or whatever it is, as Jaylen Brown is wont to do, and says, you know, goes off and tweets through it, of course, and says, you know, Grant Hill calling me a conspiracy theorist and all that other type of stuff, which I don't actually think Grant Hill did. Like, I don't know what Jaylen Brown is trying to accomplish at this point, Jake, but 2028 is going to be wide open for a lot of guys. Like, a lot of the older guys that are here now will not be around in 2028. And if you're trying to make an impression for 4 years down the line, you're not really doing a good job of it. And he's looking, as much as you could say, and there's a school of thought that says Jaylen Brown is warranted to be upset and it should be on the team. Okay, if you feel that way, fine, so be it. I don't have a problem with Derek White being there in place of Jaylen Brown. I think it's bad form for Jaylen Brown to be doing all this when your teammate is the guy who got the space, you know, ostensibly in front of you, and you're still talking about it. Like, it just seems really poor form for Jaylen Brown to take every public statement and to twist it into something that it's not intended to be.
Yeah. what you said of, I don't know what Jaylen Brown is trying to do here, I think is the nail on the head. Because to your point of the 2028 roster, this isn't benefiting anyone. I don't think it's going to come back. I mean, I saw a great tweet of someone saying, like, Steve Kerr declining Jaylen Brown, picking Derek White over him, and benching Jason Tatum behind Derek White and Drew Holiday as some next level mind game shit. But I don't think it's that real. I think this is, to your point, as simple as, look, Drew Holiday is the fifth starter on this team. I mean, basically the fourth starter on this team, but playing the fifth man role. And he's perfect at it, right? He can guard up multiple positions. He is attacking gaps with and without the ball, cutting around the baseline, cutting off the wing to score, to pass, to knock down shots when he just, you know, slips to a corner and ball swings as LeBron's driving. Like, he's in the right spot at the right time every single possession. And then when you look to replace that in the second unit, Derek White is that guy. They just did it together in Boston to win a title. And to me, it's been obvious from the get-go that he would be that type of connective, you know, late on the bench type of dude, where he also played that role with Team USA in the past in 2019 at the World Cup. So they had already seen him do that on that stage, let alone watched him continue to blossom as a Celtic, where he just signed a massive extension this year. So to me, all the basketball reasons make a ton of sense. And the only thing I'm left wondering and scratching my head at is the same thing as you. I don't know what Jaylen Brown thinks his incentives are for continuing to play this game. Maybe he's just bored and he's laughing and he's trolling us all like Joel Embiid does, to keep bringing up him and teasing him and discussion about him later in the show. But it is a question I'd like to potentially ask his people and see if maybe I could take a train up to Boston and ask him about at some point in August or September. Yeah.
I'll say this. If there's I won't say it was a mistake. I would say if there was one thing, if I were Grant Hill, that I would have done, I would have had some level of face-to-face conversation with Jaylen Brown.
And maybe they have.
Grant said that he talked to Jason Glushon, which is also the agent for Jaylen Brown and Drew Holiday, mm-hmm. who's on the team, as you mentioned. Here's the thing that I will say, and it sort of dovetails into the Jason Tatum conversation that we're going to have on the other side of the break, is you can tell Derek White, hey, go be a hound. Go defend the guy, and you're not going to get the touches, and you may not even play some games, but go there and just be a pest and do what you do, and you're going to be okay with it. Asking Jaylen Brown, the guy who's the Eastern Conference Finals MVP, the NBA Finals MVP, both rightfully so, to say at the pinnacle of your profession, you were the best player or the most impactful player. Now you're going to take a much lesser role and just defend and maybe not play and maybe not get the ball. That might be beneath Jaylen Brown at this point in his career with all the improvements that he's made. The question is, should you have asked him if he was going to be okay with that? Maybe you gleaned that he was not going to be okay with that. Maybe you wanted Derek White all along. So I think it's some combination of all three. If there was one thing, I would say maybe Grant Hill should have had a conversation with him, but I don't think that Grant Hill is calling Jaylen Brown a conspiracy theorist. I'll just leave that at that. That's it for the outlet. We're going to pause for a moment to pay some bills, and we'll be right back with the good word. Back here on A Good Word with Jake Fisher. Jake, USA ball, 110, Serbia, 84. It was almost like the perfect game. I don't think I've seen USA basketball, this iteration with Steve Kerr, play a better game. And of course, in this AAU style of play that we're in now, AAU culture, you got to complain about something. So maybe Jason Tatum has entered into the transfer portal. You know what I mean? Who knows, right? But before we can start with Jason Tatum, just to get that out the way, right? Because I want to actually talk about the basketball and the Kevin Durant, the Joel Embiid, and all that other type of stuff. Let's get the Jason Tatum stuff out the way right now. Do you have a problem with Jason Tatum not playing? Because I kind of didn't.
No, I don't have a problem with anything that happened. I don't care. These are a bunch of... Jason Tatum makes $300 million. He just won an NBA title if he wanted to be on a beach somewhere instead of be part of this team, I wouldn't have cared. If he doesn't play at all because he's got Kevin Durant and LeBron James hogging up a ton of the minute share, where they're combining for, what do they combine for, like 45 points in that game? Like, those are two of the greatest players of all time, and they are arguably the two greatest ever at that position, the like big wing that we've ever seen. So I'm sorry, JT. I know people called you champ at the golf course the week after you won the title, and you had a nice Sports Illustrated cover, but that's just the situation when you also kind of showed up a little bit late to the party, if I remember correctly, in training camp.
I think he showed up at the end of the second day, I think.
Yeah. Which I'm not saying he's being punished by that, because he was starting a bunch of exhibition games too. It's just Serbia is also a bigger team, a team that plays more traditionally with like a center and a power forward. And we've seen Steve Kerr in the past in the World Cup really play like a matchup-based system. And yeah, I think that there will be plenty of opportunity for him to play. And Kerr did a great job of what he always does, of diffusing these things, like taking shots at himself, saying, I'm an idiot for not playing a three-time in a row first-team All-NBA guy. But also, like, FIBA isn't the NBA. Mm-hmm. And he is definitely in, like, the next gen of guys that are on this team, as opposed to the old guard that's in there for one last rodeo.
Look, I think we can all agree, and this is no shot to Jason Tatum, if you give me 82 games of a healthy LeBron, 82 games of a healthy Kevin Durant, you're taking those guys in an NBA season. Like, it's not, they're not, he's not being benched for lesser players. A, it's a 40-minute game instead of 48 minutes. Playing 10 guys, which the USA did, that's kind of pushing it in itself, I think. And everybody wants to, you know, compare it to the Dream Team and everything else. I think there's some points we got to make about the Dream Team. For one, just practical points, Jake. So out of the 12 men, you know, the 12 men on the roster, excluding the egregious omission of Isaiah Thomas, which I'm going to mention every goddamn time we talk about the Dream Team, right? Cool. You're going to hear it. You're going to hear it from me. Deal with it, right? But John Stockton had a broken leg, didn't play a lot. Larry Bird had already officially retired from the NBA, or was going to officially retire, had a bad back. Christian Laettner was a college player who was entering into his first year. So out of a 12-man roster, you got three guys who weren't going to play, which left you nine, which meant everybody was going to get a decent amount of minutes, so you didn't have to necessarily worry about the massaging of, oh, is Michael going to play more than Clyde, or, you know, Barkley and Malone, or whatever it was. Like, guys were going to play just because of the sheer numbers. And this one, if you're only playing nine guys, then someone has to sit, because we ain't said jack about Tyrese Halliburton not playing. And I'm sure there's going to be games where he plays, some games where he doesn't. I'm sure there's going to be games where Derek White.
Halliburton was waving that towel as, you know, aggressively as anyone. He was up on the bench. He was clapping his hands. He was putting his hands on him. Oh, my God, Steph Curry's going off. He was great. He was the model citizen on the bench.
Yeah, so, I mean, maybe Jason Tatum's ego is a little bit bruised, you know, having gone through a very long and arduous season playoff, and then coming and dedicating and giving up a big chunk of your summer to do this. That doesn't go lightly, but everybody has done that. And Kevin Durant basically coming off of the pine and just becoming, or showing us why he is the greatest international player and the greatest international scorer of all time. Yeah, you're probably going to get bumped for Kevin Durant in that spot. And secondarily, even from a basketball standpoint, Jake, KD makes quicker snap decisions, especially in the Steve Kerr system. Tatum, he's not necessarily the guy that holds and holds and holds as much as he used to, but he's not the guy that says, oh, it's a catch and shoot opportunity, I'm going to catch and shoot. Sometimes he takes five dribbles when he needs to take two or one. And that's just some of those things in the margins. That's just how it plays. I don't think he's going to sit a whole other game. He's going to play. He's going to play a lot. People just have to find something to complain about. Like,
oh, yeah. And if you want to complain about.
Yes, it's just, and I put it like this. I do think that's unfair to him for people to be saying, go, you know, Jason, go get LeBron another Gatorade or something like that. Like, whatever, right? And if you're putting together a basketball team, I heard this on one of the morning shows. I won't say which one. Someone said, this is embarrassing to Jason Tatum's brand. And I was like, Jake, since when, like, are we building a basketball team or are we building an all-star? Is this an exhibition? Yeah. Like, which one is it? Because we were told after 2004, we have to start taking this seriously. We cannot just throw a bunch of all-stars out there. We have to take the entire process seriously. And if that's the case, in some instances, some guys won't play. We have to decide as a basketball public which one it is. And maybe we have decided and it's just a few stupid apples somewhere along the way.
Now, I'll say this too.
Go ahead.
Like, it's the same type of, you know, if you don't have haters, what are you doing? Like, the fact that it is such a story that Jason Tatum isn't playing on this all-time loaded Team USA team is a credit unto himself of all the growth that we were chronicling throughout the playoff run to the finals, where he was a playmaker and he was hitting the roll man and he was making plays to put pressure on the defense to just draw two and kick out to the corner and stuff like that, that helped Boston become the juggernaut that they were. But if you want to just do simple math here, like Devin, the wings on this team, Devin Booker was 4 of 5 from three. Mm-hmm. Kevin Durant, 8 of 9 overall, 5 of 5 from three. Jrue Holiday, 6 of 8 from the field, 3 of 5 from three. Anthony Edwards, 4 of 6 from the field, 2 of 3 from three. There wasn't really a player who like didn't have it. So there's going to be a game where, you know, Bam doesn't play that. I'm just throwing out a random name because it could be anyone. So I hope for the discourse sake, especially if Team USA keeps rolling such as this, like they'll have a game where necessarily they don't need to win or have the point differential. Like, I mean, Serbia was supposed to be their biggest competition in this opening group and they blasted them by damn near 30 points. So I think it's going to be easy to find a lot of guys' minutes and there will be other guys who are in the Jason Tatum not playing role throughout this tournament.
Yeah, and I was talking to a GM yesterday and he said, well, I would play Jason Tatum over Devin Booker. And I'm like, I said the same thing you did. He was 4 of 5 from three. He was defensively really good. Like all the guards, I think, were really good defensively in that first game against Serbia. Like I don't really have a quibble with Steve Kerr, coach. I know there's a segment of people that think Steve Kerr is not a good coach, and maybe you can have your quibbles with that. All right, cool, whatever. You know, plant your Jonathan Kuminga flag wherever you want to plant it. Okay, cool. But the other player who people have had a lot to say about, and it was mentioned in the open, is Joel Embiid, who just does not look like a fit for the roster. And you mentioned him being wined and dined by, you know, the fringe group and being able to put him with Victor Wembanyama and Rudy Gobert. Like, that would have been a terror for the United States, even if they don't use Joel Embiid to full capacity here. Just playing defense against French, and not like actual defense on the floor, but like defense against France, keeping him away is a plus. But from the standpoint of basketball fit, and I thought about this, Jake, and you watch a lot of Joel Embiid, like you're around there. He doesn't make quick decisions. And I feel like in the FIBA game, you don't have time to stop and probe and lean and dip your shoulder and try to, you know, get those fouls and everything else. Like, I just think that he's not built for the FIBA game. In addition to him, every time he touches the ball, it's like showtime at the Apollo out there, man. Boo! They cannot stand his ass out there. I mean, rightfully so, right? But how do you see his fit on this roster? It's not an indictment of him as an NBA player, I don't think. It just doesn't seem like he's a fit for FIBA basketball.
I think he can fit because, you know, there is a lot of opportunity for post play. You're allowed to get away with, you know, some deeper shoulders and stuff like that. And in Steve Kerr's system, where there's a lot of stuff from Golden State, where you throw the ball into the pinch post, you can make plays out of that. His passing, I think, still is very underrated because he doesn't, in the past, he hasn't had too many teammates in Philadelphia that are worthy of those passes, let's say. And I think in this new iteration of the Sixers, that ball is going to be popping around the perimeter more, and he'll be, you know, making more swings to the opposite corner and stuff like that. But you saw in that New York series that he was had some games with 6, 7, 8 assists and stuff like that. I think, to your point, there is just, you know, there were promises made for him to be in the starting lineup. He is the greatest center in the league outside of Nikola Jokic. So he's going to have that hierarchy. He's going to walk into that room, and AD and Bam aren't going to think, you know, this guy is in a class unto himself because they're competitors and all NBA guys and all stars to their own, right? But he's the only guy of that group that has an MVP to his name and has been finishing top two or three in that category pretty much every year he's been healthy the last half decade. So that's, I think, expected. It's just, yeah, when you do get caught in these one-on-one battles with Jokic and you're trying to take 3-4 dribble, it's the same thing with Tatum too. And I saw KD, and this can be a transition into that portion of this area. I saw KD in one of his classic tweet exchanges talking about the beautifulness of the game and playing random basketball. That is the maybe weird, not so hand and glove fit about this, is that when you throw the ball into the block to Joel Embiid, you limit that randomness. You limit the outcomes and the range of outcomes that the other four guys can do when he's taking his time and he's clearing out space with all that he has to his body. And I think everyone could benefit from, you know, it's when he was playing in the exhibition game, I forget which game he had 15 and looked good, but when he's out there setting screens for Steph 40 feet from the basket and he's running pin downs and stuff like that's where he can really, I think, shine in this setting. It's not going to be his preferred, you know, let me get that thing on the block and take half the shot clock and do my thing.
Yeah. Look, I've missed post play in NBA. Like, let me make that perfectly clear. I don't like the NBA that basically is driving kick, driving kick, driving kick. Sometimes you need to throw the ball down to the big boy and wear somebody's ass out. Like, that's basketball that I grew up watching. Like, I like the variety of it. I like the game as a whole, but I do miss that element of it. It's just not a big time place for it in this spot for Embiid. And especially when you look at the other side and Jokic, whenever he was on the floor, they play USA to a standstill. I think some of those numbers were skewed by the good first quarter that Serbia had. But when he was off, they were outscored by 26. He was off the floor for 9 minutes, and it was 29-3 or something like that. Like, they couldn't score. They could barely get shots up. It literally looked like they could barely get the ball past half court. Now we get to the fun part of USA basketball, and we kind of teased it a little bit earlier, but Kevin Durant being arguably the best international player that we've ever seen. He holds all the scoring records. He's going for another gold medal. He hasn't played a game since late April. He came into USA camp with nursing a calf injury that nobody was really concerned about, and people wanted to make a big deal out of Kevin Durant still being on the roster, but Kawhi Leonard not. And I'm like, one thing is not like the other, right? And this is what this is. Kevin Durant is not like any other player. He literally walked onto the floor and hit his first 8 shots, right? And they weren't all open. But he is so, he's historically good. Like, in whatever basketball context you want to talk about him, as you said, you know, he and LeBron might be the two best wing forwards to ever play the game. Larry Bird might have something to say about that conversation, but
for sure,
they're in the conversation. But Kevin Durant, just, were you as amazed as I was, or were you even not surprised that there looked to be zero rust on Kevin Durant walking onto the floor?
I wasn't surprised because we had heard behind the scenes that he was like this close to playing in that last exhibition game and that he'd been playing in scrimmages. And one thing that is very different about the Olympic schedule compared to the World Cup schedule is that there's a lot of time off between games.
Mm-hmm.
So there's plenty of opportunity for rest and recovery and scrimmage stuff and whatever. And this is a guy who just likes to be on a court with a ball in his hands and a basket to be absolutely throwing flamethrowers through. So we couple all that with the shorter line and the fact this dude's been itching to play for the last week plus. It kind of reminded me a touch of him coming back for that quick flurry in the finals.
Yeah.
And I was my one reaction was more so like, please don't have a repeat of that.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
even saying that out loud is like a, because I mean, I think you and I both have a real appreciation for what he does on both sides of the floor from our mutual time here in Brooklyn through now. And when he's just healthy and locked in, I mean, he's got the prettiest jumper off the dribble, I think, just because he's so tall and he brings it from the opposite hip. And that pull up at the top of the key that he was hitting in LeBron's eye to win a couple of finals in Golden State, like, it's a lot easier to do from a shorter line over Filip Petrušev. So I wasn't so surprised. I was more, you know, shaking my head and being like, yep, that's KD.
Look, it just takes me back to 2019 NBA Finals. I remember being there and Golden State was down 3-1 and KD was warming up, but you didn't really know if he was going to play. And then you get the word that he's playing and it's he against Kawhi Leonard. And that's when I really felt like for that quarter and maybe 2 minutes into the second quarter, I was like, oh, the finals are here. Like, we get to see.
I remember thinking Golden State was going to come back and win.
Yep, that was going to be Kevin Durant's parting shot to everybody there. Like, y'all don't think I'm that valuable. I'm going to carry this thing back from 3-1 with my single. Like you're going to pry this thing away from my cold, dead hands, right? And he was hitting those pull-ups over the best, like, wing defender in the game, and it looked like he wasn't being bothered. And all of a sudden, boom. As soon as he went down, you're like, oh, crap, it's his Achilles. So even just to see him back, not just from the Achilles, to see him back from the MCL. And now, Jake, I'm looking at it, and we're talking about the Phoenix Suns earlier, and not to say they're not a real team, but if he were on a better constructed team, we'd still be talking about Kevin Durant as the best player in the game. We'd legit, in my opinion, Jake, we would still be talking about all the things that he can do from playing the small ball five, to being able to handle it, to being able to defend at all three levels and score at all three levels. We would still be saying Kevin Durant is in the conversation for best player in the game if he played on a better team.
Yeah, they were just undermanned all last season. And I wrote about it right around the trade deadline because I was in Atlanta for a few days for a bunch of stuff. That was like my most productive trip of the season, where I sat down with Jalen Johnson, did a whole thing with him, and then Golden State and Phoenix was in town. What a dream West Coast matchup slate on an East Coast, you know, weekend swing. And I got KD post game, and I hadn't seen him in person in a long time. And when you're standing next to him one-on-one, you just really remember how fucking long and huge he is. And also, I went into that game with this bug in my ear from a coaching friend who had watched him lead this crazy 15-point fourth quarter comeback that I've talked about probably on the No Cap Room a couple times already, where he was playing small ball five for them and he switches out onto guards and bigs and wings and everyone in between. And in that Atlanta game, he went every single time down the floor to score, and then he was switching on to DeJounte Murray, and DeJounte had his way and Atlanta won. But his ability to not just be that lethal scorer, but to do it on both ends, I thought was something that didn't get, to your point, enough attention last season because Phoenix just wasn't that good. And they still got the sixth seed and they made the playoffs and what have you. But we saw in that matchup with Minnesota that the Suns just weren't deep enough. They didn't have the firepower beyond those big three that the Suns brass are so confident about. And we'll see. I mean, they've made some smart moves here on the margins, like we talked about at the top with Tyus Jones, and Monty Morris should also be a real stabilizing force now. I mean, I think Monty Morris probably is one person who's a little bit raising an eyebrow at the Tyus Jones situation, but I think it's a huge win for Phoenix to have both those guys now after having really no bona fide NBA point guard. And they have Colin Gillespie on a two-way, who I'm not expecting to like lead the Suns in point guard minutes, but is a real legit player and was arguably one of the best U League players in the league last year, and has 2 years with the champion Denver Nuggets under his belt. So they've got, I think, some help now. And that, you know, the roster is still not incomplete. They've got Nasir Little's salary to trade. They're doing smart things on the margins, like trading David Roddy to Atlanta last week to bring back salary that they can just waive to, you know, get little savings here and there. And the second round pick stuff they've done has been creative. You know, they traded down on draft night, which I thought was pretty widely signaled around the league, but you pick up some capital and then you get your guy Ryan Dunn, who you wanted anyway. So I think there's definitely a lot of smart stuff happening in Phoenix to build this thing out and to give Kevin Durant the real, like, earnest last opportunity that clearly he's showing with Team USA that he's capable of deserving.
Look, if you make the game easy for Kevin Durant will make life a lot easier for you. Speaking of that, like, if there's a guy that, who I want to see a camera following around through this entire experience, can we put a camera or one of those drones around the Ant-Man? Because I just want to see the Ant-Man. Like, he was talking about the table tennis. Did you see that clip of Ant talking to the table tennis people? And they were like, man, we would 21 you. Or Steph was instigating. Like, Steph is one of those quiet people in, like, the lunchroom that would say, hey, man, I bet you won't step over that line and go over there, would you? You ain't going to step over that line. And Ant goes and step over the line. Next thing you know, you got to fight. And Steph is just sitting back there like, man, I don't know what happened. Like, that's the type of dude Steph is. You got to watch out for Steph. Steph kind of sneaky with it. But Ant just seems so delightful to just be in that space. And there's just this authentic element to him that if you put him against Simone Biles, and it says, Ant, do you think you could do what Simone Biles does? He would probably be like, yeah, I could do what Simone Biles does. I could do anything. Like, he
and
just
sat there with a floor routine trying to land a double axel or whatever.
Yes. Look, you could do everything. We'll put ice skates on Ant. I think that's the one thing that he wouldn't do. I think that's a little bit more for our Winter Olympics people. You know what I mean? A little bit too Americas. But I think for everything in the Summer Olympics, maybe not the surfing, right? Maybe not the surfing. But even the surfing, I think Ant would be like, yeah, I could do that.
Listen, as an amateur surfer who just tried to get out on the board last Saturday
for the first time of the year.
By amateur surfer, I mean I've surfed less than 10 times in my life, but I have a board and a wetsuit, and I was out there for about an hour last Saturday.
Can you swim?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I grew up at the beach with my family. I know the rhythms of the waves. I can catch a wave. It's about figuring out exactly how to master staying afloat and standing on it. But yeah, I could catch a wave. I'm out there sitting on the board, you know, wiping my hair back. It's a good time, man. It's a great time.
I'll take your word for it because I definitely fulfill the stereotype.
You can't swim?
I've taken swimming lessons like 2 times in my life.
Oh, Vinny.
And it has not taken. Now,
can I paddle?
Can I tread water? Like, it'd be a few seconds before, you know, like Super Mario Brothers, where you just start doo 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 doo. Like, it'd be a few seconds before I go all the way down. But yeah, I'd be going down. That's a conversation for another. I think it's like the doing two things at once thing that gets me.
Got it.
It's moving the legs and the arms.
You're saying you can't do two things at once in general, or just when you're in water and you're starting to panic?
Oh, I can do two things at once. It's just those two things at once that I'm not very good at, okay?
Take that
how you will. Now, we're going to take our last ad break, and we'll be right back to talk about USA's next game against South Sudan. Back here on A Good Word. Now, Jake, the USA, I think a couple weeks ago in one of their exhibition games, they were a 42-point favorite against South Sudan, and they found themselves in a dogfight. That was the game where LeBron James had to do the driving layup to win the game, and I think Ant had to foul someone underneath the basket, and the refs swallowed their whistles because they didn't want any problems out there. But
It was the USA basketball showcase. It wasn't
there we go.
The USA versus South Sudan showcase. Let's be clear.
You said it, not me. I mean, look. Here's the thing about USA basketball. They don't actually bring in money, so they have to make money. That's what that is. You have to start making money. So what do? You go to places that want to see you play and will pay premium top dollar to do so. And you play one game in Vegas and then you go play everywhere else. It's a very simple equation. Now, South Sudan even being here is an accomplishment, right? Luol Deng, former NBA player, Royal Ivy, who I think, you know, should be starting to get some NBA real coaching looks because of the job that he's done,
yeah,
you know, with South Sudan. You know, South Sudan, they beat Puerto Rico in the first game, 90-79, I believe, right before the USA played. Do you think there is any cause for worry in this matchup, or did the USA get their wake-up call initially in that USA basketball showcase?
I am not worried for Team USA. I think they're a great story. Yes, I think Royal Ivy will start to get some buzz in coaching stuff. I don't know for certain, but I believe he was at least a name bandied about on the interview circuit for Charlotte this past summer, although there was definite expectation that job was going to go to Charles Lee, as it did. But, you know, Jeff Peterson coming over from Brooklyn, Royal Ivy was an assistant in Brooklyn for several years, both with Kevin Durant and beyond Kevin Durant.
Right.
So that connection was obvious of why he'd be someone on that interview radar. And what he's doing with South Sudan has to be getting attention for sure. There's no NBA player, no active NBA player on this roster, despite Carlick Jones's storied two-way experience and Wendell Gabriel's had, you know, cups of coffee with the Lakers and the Kings and what have you. But I just don't think this roster has the true firepower to compete. I mean, the exhibition play was terrific, and Carlick is great, and he's making a lot of money overseas for good reason. But I don't think they have enough to compete with a team that can bench Jason Tatum and win by 30. So it will be, I think, interesting just to see how much Team USA wants to maybe exact some revenge from that potential near embarrassment that almost came at the exhibition. But also, South Sudan, you know, they're the 33rd ranked team in the world. That's not nothing. Like, only 32 teams qualify for the World Cup, so as they did a year ago. So they're a real player in this FIBA landscape. That doesn't mean that they have a real opportunity to compete with the big boys and in this 12-team field. For those of our listeners who aren't like fully aware, there's some jankiness to how certain teams get into this field because there's a representative of the continent of Africa, and the competition is not nearly the same as you have to get out of Europe, for example. Like, Lithuania not being in this tournament is because there's Greece, and there's Serbia, and there's France, and there's Spain, and there could have been however many teams from Croatia and whoever. So, like, I think they had an easier road just by being the top finishing team of all the African teams in the World Cup play a year ago. And same thing with Australia and the Pacific Island. You know, that bracket is not nearly as competitive, even as, you know, Canada and the U.S. have to go through in the North American pool, where you've had, you know, Puerto Rico is in this as well. Like, that is what it is, but that's not to take away from what they've built, because South Sudan's like one of the youngest countries in the world. And the fact that they have put together this program with, you know, major respect to Luol Deng, who by all accounts has been the bankroll to, and, you know, Team USA doesn't have to pay these guys because it's an honor, but for a lot of these other programs, like, you're shelling out cash to get certain players to come play for you. And that's just kind of a shadow part of the FIBA game. And there's strings being pulled to get certain guys, certain passports and what have you. So Luol Deng definitely deserves a lot of credit for what he's done to help put this program on the map.
Yeah. But in short, and the game is, I think, Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern. I think that's
correct.
9 p.m. game in France because of the 6-hour difference. I don't anticipate that it will be as close, but I do think that the U.S. could have problems with more athletic teams, because you look at U.S. and you see the skill, but you don't see the big, super big, strong guys. Like LeBron even has to pick and choose his spots. And he was excellent in the first game, but you can see some people dotting LeBron's eye a few times, like not being afraid of him getting down in the defensive stance. Like you see more skill and more, you know, end-to-end stuff, but not necessarily short burst quickness that the U.S. has. You know, that's why you have the Embiids and the Bams and the ADs at the rim, because you don't necessarily have those big, strong wings. Like you don't have an Aaron Gordon there. You don't have a Jaylen Brown there. Like that's some of the things that you give up, even though the U.S. has an embarrassment of riches in terms of talent, and we are expecting them to roll through this entire tournament to win yet another gold medal. But the gold medal for the day goes to my man, Jake Fisher. Jake, thanks for running shotgun with me, man. Appreciate you.
Got it, man. Always happy to be here. Happy to see your sneaker collection and remind myself that it's better than mine.
I'm older than you. That's all. That's all. I'm just old. I just have more years of building this up. That's all. Don't forget to check Jake out here at Yahoo Sports. Don't forget to check out his pod, No Cap Room. And also, thanks again to producer John and the entire team who works hard behind the scenes on this show. Of course, Jake will have No Cap Room on Thursday. I'll be back next week as I return from the National Association of Black Journalists Convention in Chicago. Please don't embarrass me, y'all. Until then, everybody be safe.